Hey guys, I just want to start off by saying thank you for listening to the podcast. But I can't stress enough how important it is for me to continue on producing content, for you to go on and leave us a review on iTunes or the Podbean app. Your questions and comments help me keep this thing going, and it's really important for the podcast. The more reviews we get and the higher up in the ranking I go, the more people I could reach. It's really important for you to do so. If you really like the podcast, we'd like to hear from you, and we would really, really appreciate the feedback and reviews. Also want to take a little bit of time here real quick to thank Phoenix Shooting Bags for their continued support of the podcast. And if you want to up your shooting game, go check them out, phoenixshootingbags.com. You can use promo code John Stallone, all one word, and purchase bags for 20% off. So check them out. This, honestly, it's a game changer, and you won't be disappointed. So phoenixshootingbags.com. Let's roll into the next episode. Hi, welcome to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters, brought to you by the Sneak Tech Sneak Boot and Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today we're actually live at the Hunting Expo here in Salt Lake, and I'm in the Hunting Fool booth, and Hunting Fool's been a big help to me over the last few years, helped me get a lot of tags and give me guidance through a lot of stuff, and I always go to him for questions and whatnot, and I have Austin Atkinson with me, and we're going to do a little storytelling session, and hear about his past adventures and maybe one of his most memorable hunts. What's going on, man?
How are you?
Good.
Glad to see you here today at the show.
Yeah, I'm in and out. In and out. I flew in. I caught a 6:40 flight from Phoenix, and I'm leaving at 2:45 today.
Oh, short day.
Yeah. Came to validate my tags, do a couple podcasts, and then I have to meet up with the guys at Sneak Tech and do a couple quick things, and then I'm out.
Then you're out. Well, yeah. You got your name in the hat for the tags, so that's the important part.
Honestly, I think that's 95% of the reason why I flew here.
It is.
Because you got to validate it.
Yep. You got to be here.
So, and I know a lot of guys that have actually won a raffle, or one guy got a tag anyway through this. So it's pretty legit. I mean, it's pretty much your
it
best.
Is.
You know, I mean, especially for those upper end hunts like sheep and stuff.
Yep.
I know a lot of the other sheep tags that you can get, like through the not directly through Utah, the ones you have to be present for are actually fantastic odds.
They are, yeah. Through the Full Curl Society, they do that on Saturday.
Yeah.
And a lot of them you have to be present to win. And
yeah.
If you're not there, they're pulling another ticket.
Yeah, I know. I heard about last year some guy was in the bathroom.
Oh.
And they moved, and he moved on to the next guy, and he was like, "What?"
You'd be
but
sick.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That would be
I'd
bad.
I don't know what I'd do.
Yeah,
Jesus, definitely don't eat any Taco Bell before you go to one of those.
No.
So, yeah, you had pretty. I saw you killed a musk ox. How was that?
That was my most recent hunt, and it was an adventure.
Yeah,
I've kind of decided that. Once in a lifetime tags, you know, we use that a lot.
Yeah.
Once in a lifetime. I mean, my wife doesn't believe that phrase anymore.
I mine either.
But there truly are some hunts that I would consider to be once in a lifetime, and this muskox hunt was one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Something you want to do once. I think we all want to do it, but I probably will never do it again.
Yeah.
You know, sort of deal.
Is it just miserable?
I actually drew the tag,
okay.
Which is pretty cool. Alaska has a draw for the winter tags.
Right.
They gave 75 tags last year. It's usually about 50 or 60 bull tags.
Okay.
So I got lucky and drew this tag. And my dad said, I've been applying for 30 years. I've never drawn. I'm going with you.
Nice.
And so we turned it into a father-son adventure. And if you've seen a muskox hunt, they're not inherently hard to kill.
No.
Well, a lot of the mountain hunting I do and sheep hunts, it's tough
yeah.
to find the animal. It's tough to kill the animal. Muskox hunt, not really hard
no.
to kill them, but to get there, to survive the weather and the elements and to get out. I mean, that was the adventure.
Yeah.
It was a 10-day adventure for us from the time we left home by the time we got back. And it was about an hour and a half of actual hunting.
Wow.
And that's it. Right in the middle.
That's crazy. But
it was a wild place. Going to Alaska in January, not the best time of year to go.
Right.
You got about 6 hours of daylight. Everything's frozen, snowy, just miserable.
Yeah.
But
don't they have an early hunt on that too?
They do a fall hunt as okay. well.
I was going to say, I thought I remember seeing one like September or something like along those lines.
Yeah, they give about a dozen bull tags in the fall.
Okay.
That one, they usually use boats because most of the island where I hunted on Nunavak Island uh-huh. is a wilderness area.
Okay.
So you can't ride a four-wheeler or can't do anything on the tundra because it'll damage it. So they use boats in the fall.
I just circle around and keep going back.
Yep.
Okay.
But they do allow snowmobiling in the winter.
Right.
So that's why I wanted to do the winter hunt.
Nice.
Big long hair. It's just like the muskox experience, right? And so you fly out to the island. By the time you get there, you land on this icy runway, and there's a little village of about 150 people that uh-huh. live on the island, all native Alaskans. And you have to pay them as a transporter to rent a snowmobile from them.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're just on this island.
Right.
No vehicles, no roads, nothing. So you can stay at their little homes, and then they'll rent you a snowmobile.
Nice.
But my dad and I said, we want to go to the next level to make it more of an adventure, and we shipped all our camping gear up there.
Oh, God.
So we loaded all our camping gear up into this sled behind a snowmobile that we rented, and we snowmobiled out 35 miles to the other end of the island. And I've been some remote places, John, but this was the most remote I've ever felt. It was quiet. There was sea ice right on the Bering Sea.
Oh, my God.
And just flat snow land as far as you can see. And we...
Just desolate.
Like, yeah. It almost felt scary, like eerie feeling, you know, because uh-huh. you're like, I don't think we're supposed to be out here this time of year. This is crazy.
Yeah.
Everything
so
froze.
Much to go so wrong so quick.
Yep. We were breaking through ice on this little freshwater lake to get our water, and we found this old little caribou reindeer herd hut that provided us some shelter from the wind, and we actually pitched our tent inside of this hut for insulation because the wind was blowing 30 to 40 miles an hour the whole time.
I gotta imagine. It's wide open. There's no trees. There's nothing, right?
Yeah. Nope. There's no brush, no trees, no bears, no wolves. There's nothing out there. But some muskox and some wolves. Or some foxes, sorry.
Foxes.
And that's it. So it was a pretty cool place. And we were out there 3 days before the season opened. So after you sleep 12 hours, it's still dark. You wait a few more hours for the sun to come up. Then we'd go out and we'd scout on the snowmobile, look for these herds of muskox until we found what we thought was the biggest muskox around.
Right.
We really didn't know how to judge them. We're like, this is a bull. It's got good drop. Yeah. We think this is one. And they're not too hard to get close to. You get a couple hundred yards pretty easy.
Okay.
So we scouted them out for a few days, waiting for opening day. We wanted to be there on February 1st. And, man, when opening day came, we were excited. We put literally every layer and insulation piece we owned on to survive, goggles, face masks, the whole nine yards. Snowmobiled out and parked the snowmobile and then just kind of hiked along the edge of the cliffs right on the ocean of the Bering Sea.
Okay.
Found the herd of muskox we were going after, and then you kind of just play with them, you know, see how to get close to them because they're inherently don't run away. It's deep snow. Mm-hmm. They bunch up.
Right. And it's, which is, can't get a shot off.
Can't get a shot. I mean, that's an archery hunter's nightmare when they bunch up. Which one am I shooting at? Does he have another animal behind him? It was kind of difficult to get a clear shot. So we played with them for about an hour, trying to get the big bull to clear the group. And eventually they worked their way over to the edge of the cliff. And we knew the only way they could go now was single file past me.
Okay.
So I posted up with my Matthews bow and just kind of waited for him to come by me. And my dad was running the video camera, and it's just freezing rain and snowing and blowing sideways. So I knew I couldn't take a long shot.
Right.
But finally, they kind of walked out single file past me at 21 yards, and the big bull was in the back, and I could see there was no legs behind him. He was clear, and I let him have it.
Awesome.
So it was a pretty fun once-in-a-lifetime moment to arrow this muskox. He ran about 60 yards, got sick, and started to tip over, and the second lead bull in the group, he came over and just hammered the other one, just pounded heads and made sure he was not coming with them. And then the whole herd took off and left him there, and he died right there.
Jesus. That's rough. Yeah, here's my opportunity to take over the herd. Kick a man when he's down.
He knew that he was going down, and he hammered him down.
That's crazy.
So pretty neat. And then you're left with this huge animal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's below freezing temperatures. And so we got to work quick, took some photos, and then tried to figure out how to skin this animal. They look as big as a bison when you see them.
Right.
You know, alive, but it's so much hair.
Right. Yeah, that's what I heard. I heard, like, they're, like, 30 or 40% hair. Some crazy.
It's crazy.
Crazy number. Yeah.
A lot of that hair is 18 inches long. Yeah, it is ridiculous.
Nuts. Well, they got it. They need that for. Well, how cold was it?
You know, most of our temperatures, it wasn't too cold. We were single digits to 10 degrees, but. The wind chill is what killed us. Yeah. It's blowing 20 to 40 miles an hour the whole time. So
yeah, that's nuts.
Wind chill is probably just below zero most of the time. But you know, without a warm place to go back to, you got to have the right gear to be able to come back into your little shack in the tent and stay warm.
Nuts. Yeah, wind's a mother. It really is.
It is.
We hunt in South Dakota every year. I run a couple hunts there. And every year, I mean, it's cold. We get... You know, we're in the teens, not like super, super cold, but, you know, single digits some mornings. And this is in November. So if I went, you know, closer to December, it gets a lot colder. I did a tree stand hunt there from Whitetail once, and it was absolutely miserable. but the wind, it's literally blowing 20 miles an hour to 30 miles an hour all day long. And
cuts
you're like,
through you.
Fuck, this sucks, man. This sucks. But luckily, you see a shit ton of animals, and you're like, okay, it makes it better, you know?
Right.
I definitely couldn't do that if I wasn't seeing shit. But, that's crazy. You know what I always worried about seeing that? You didn't have it quite as cold, but to go in places like that with a bow, and I know it's been a number of years because they've changed the technology on limbs and stuff like that. Did your bow shoot differently at that temperature? Did you notice it was shooting slower or faster or anything like that?
You know, I didn't really notice. I shot it a few times up there to make sure, you know, the string, everything stayed on and it felt right. But I didn't shoot it out. It was blowing so hard
that you knew you weren't going to shoot
it. I wasn't shooting further than 30 yards, even at the target, just to feel comfortable with it. But one thing I did was make sure I kept it in a case the whole entire time. I built a thin, soft case for it with a sling. And even when I was starting my stock, it was in that. So there was no ice, no snow on the limbs or the cams or my sight. And I was crawling up to the muskox when I pulled it out finally.
Okay.
And that's clipped my release on. So I kept everything covered and cold so that there wasn't any condensation or ice on it.
Yeah.
But it was still a gamble. I did have a rifle back at camp in case, you know, my bow blew up or whatever could happen. You know, you never know when you're that far from
home.
That
happened to me in the late 90s. And I was hunting, and it was really, really cold. And I went and drew back the bow, and it snapped the limb snap.
Oh, yeah, I worried about that.
But. And it, I'm trying to think of how cold it was. It wasn't like it was like you wouldn't think that would affect it, but it was. I would say probably like 9 degrees. It wasn't like below zero. You know,
had a mixture of moisture or something.
I mean, you know, back then, who knows the frick I did to that bow. Probably dropped it 100 times. But it's just, I always often wonder about that, like when I'm on those hunts that are really cold, if my bow's gonna get jacked up somehow. And
I know I worried about it a lot. I was very fortunate that the arrow, I kind of hit him in the lungs, kind of backside of the lungs, and didn't pass all the way through with the hair. It came out about 8 inches on the other side, so I could see the broadhead hanging one side and the veins hanging out the other side, so I knew we had a good hit on him. Because once they bunched back up and ran off, it was hard to tell which one was him.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Until he started acting sick, then it was obvious that was him. But I'll tell you, once we got all the hair off him, we skinned him for a life-size mount.
Yeah.
And so that took us a while. But once you get
it
off.
What did that cape weigh?
I'll tell you, the
like
cape.
500 pounds.
When we put it on the plane, we wrapped it in a tarp because we didn't have a tote big enough. So I wrapped it in a single-layer tarp, put a whole bunch of paracord around it, and it weighed 104 pounds.
Jesus Christ.
It was a heavy, heavy cape, and that's just straight hair. He was a little wet, but just hair.
Wow.
And the body of these things, it looks like a spike elk, like pretty small once you get all the hair off.
Yeah, that's
very manageable.
That's what I heard. I've heard them, compared to cow elk, but spike elk, that makes sense too. Yeah, and it's something I definitely would like to do. But it's not something like you you'd want to do every year. Like, I could see that not being.
I mean, it'd be fun to hunt them. We enjoyed the experience and seeing them and judging them and killing one. And then we started the exit plan of loading it up in the sled, getting all the meat, you know, deboned and taken care of before it froze solid on us. And we got transported back all the way to the village, busted a sled, blew up a snowmobile. I mean, all the typical things you can.
Normal crap.
Yeah, just normal living in a little village. But we got back to the village, got delayed another 3 days before we finally got the plane to come in and get us out. Unreal. Gear got bumped. I mean, we were trying to bring as much meat as we can because the meat's excellent. But we finally got out of there and just one thing fell through after another. Typical Alaska in the winter. Mm-hmm. But we did make it home, and I had my cape and my skull at home with me when I got off the plane. So I was excited about that.
That's awesome. Hell yeah.
Yep.
So what did the airline charge you to take that cape home? Under 40 pounds? Like $400?
No. You can't take a bag over 99.9 pounds on the airlines, right?
Oh, shit. Okay.
You have to send it cargo. So we had them talked into, I put 4 pounds of tarp and paracord on there. So really the item was only 99 pounds. And so they let it on
nice
carefully, but put frozen stickers on it and they shipped it home just like a box of fish meat, you know?
Okay. Nice.
So we got it home, but a logistical nightmare. Everything in Alaska costs money. Everything is a logistical mess and plans fall through. You're really on village time, they call it, where the plane will come whenever it's ready. Yeah. Well, I have a ticket. Well, the ticket doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're coming when we're ready and when it's safe to do so. And the weather's just been a mess this year. So all those costs added up. Mm-hmm. So you have to pay the transporter to rent a snowmobile about $4,000.
Wow.
Just for a couple days. You know, you've got the $2,200 tag just to buy the locking tag to put on your animal as a non-resident. So you're going to be into it $7,000 or $8,000. Wow. Unguided.
Unguided. That's nuts.
So for that reason, it's a once-in-a-lifetime hunt for me.
Yeah. I mean,
something you want to do, but can't afford to do it every year. There's too many other things.
Hunting full for a race.
Yeah. We got to sell some more memberships.
Oh, geez. So speaking of Alaska, actually, and we briefly talked about this, but because I'm interested in doing the Sitka Blacktail, and I know a lot of guys that I've been talking around, you know, with, and I got a couple of my close friends like Charles Whitman and my cousin Anthony from Phoenix Shooting Bags. We want to do that hunt. Hey guys, just a quick interruption here. I'm going to be trying out a new segment of the podcast where we bring on you, the listener, to share one of your hunting stories with us. So just kind of testing the waters here and seeing what interest there is in this and how well it goes. So if you're interested in it, go to my blog, johnstallone.me. And basically subscribe there and drop me a line saying, hey, I would love to be on the show. You know, we'll start putting a couple of them out there and seeing how well they do. And hopefully it'll be something that sticks and we'll be able to have you guys interacting with the podcast here on a weekly basis. Thanks, and we'll get back to the episode.
For sure.
So, and I know you've been kind of doing that on... Yeah, for the last few years.
Yeah, we have been. There's a few different options when you're hunting Sitka Blacktail. You can go fully guided, which can get a little expensive. Mm-hmm. Or you can do a drop-off tent camp. That's the cheapest.
Right.
Pay a plane to drop you off on Kodiak Island and set up shack and stay there for a week. That's the cheapest option. Or you can do what we did, which is a boat transported hunt.
Okay.
That's kind of been my favorite.
Right.
And so there's these transporters on Kodiak Island that offer these boat services where it's a live aboard boat. You can stay on the boat for about 7 days and they feed you. They take care of you. You got a nice warm bunk to sleep in, bathroom on the boat.
Sounds more my speed.
Yeah. And the biggest part is when you kill something, you can hang your meat on the boat, on the back deck.
You don't have to worry about grizzlies coming together.
Exactly. Yeah. And you take all the Kodiak brown bears out of the equation. Yeah. Which is frustrating when you're in a tent because every non-resident can have 3 deer tags so you can shoot 3 bucks.
Wow, that's huge.
So you kill one. If you're in a tent, you're like, where am I going to hang this? A bear's going to tear into it, and then you're nervous. And the other big thing about a boat is you can move every day when you wake up.
Not seeing anything, go to a different area. Yeah,
yep.
It's a lot easier.
Tell the transporter. They're not guides. They're just transporters. But you say, I'd like to go over to this bay if you think it's safe. Take you over there. They run you in a skiff from their, you know, 50-foot boat. They run you into shore, drop you off, give you a lunch and a radio, and say, call us when you get back to the beach. We'll pick you up.
Nice.
And then you're just hunting on your own. So it's a self-guided hunt. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's reasonably priced, but you are have the help of those guys.
Yeah,
you
do
have
huge.
Their help. Which
I think that's something. And the fact that you could get three is awesome, because I know me, I would definitely go there. I'm definitely going to bring the bow and the rifle. I'm going to go out, shoot one with the rifle right off the bat. Just I don't care what it looks like.
Yeah.
Just to say I got one, and then I'm going to hunt with the bow.
Yeah, and then you can hunt the rest of the time.
Yeah.
And outside of that.
And I want a fox really bad, too.
Oh, man, there's so many foxes.
I'm a big predator hunter, and yep. I want to get all the species I possibly can, and that's, like, it's cool as shit, man.
And it's not uncommon every day to see a silver fox, the cross fox, and a red fox up
yeah.
there, and they're just big and fluffy. And that's so awesome. We shoot fox. We also shot sea ducks.
Oh, yeah.
We have the harlequins and all these really cool duck-type
yeah.
waterfowl that you can hunt
right
from the boat, right from the shore, and then fishing.
Yeah.
When the weather's really bad or at night or whenever, we caught big halibut. We caught ling cod, rockfish, everything.
Nice.
So we were eating fish, steak. I mean, it was the ultimate
nice.
Surf and turf.
Oh, yeah.
We drop crab pots and catch dungy crabs. I mean, it's like the ultimate Alaska experience for a guy that is on a budget or just wants to go have a fun time. Because
oh,
you
yeah.
can do the whole trip with everything for under $5,000 per person.
See, that's
tags,
doable.
Flights, everything.
That's doable for anybody. If you're smart about your money, you just save up. Even if it takes you 2-3 years.
Exactly.
Whatever, I mean, you could do it.
Yep, and so we would get a group together of 4, 6, 8 people mm-hmm. together, and so you have the whole boat to yourself. It's just your group, and it's a riot.
Yeah.
You get very little sleep because you're so busy fishing and hunting, but it's fun.
I don't get sleep anyway, even when I'm home, so it doesn't matter. I'm used to running on 3-4 hours of sleep.
There you go.
Good. I get 4 hours, I'm Gucci.
Yeah.
So.
But that's something you want to do for that trip. It's getting popular,
mm-hmm.
so you definitely want to plan it a year or two out
yeah.
to get good dates. I prefer early October when there's still high country.
Okay.
A lot of guys like to go in November during the rut,
yeah.
a little bit lower, closer to the shore. But you're at sea level where you start every day, so
yeah.
it's not high altitude. I mean, it's easy.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard the hardest thing is getting through the brush.
The brush on Kodiak is something else.
Yeah.
It's not like brush anywhere else.
It's like a wall.
It's a wall. Some of it yeah. you cannot push through no yeah. matter how hard you try. You just have to go around. But you learn pretty quick how to pick your routes. And
yeah.
you say, no, don't drop me off over there. Drop yeah. me off over here.
There
this
go.
Looks a little better. You know, and to the top, most of those hills from the beach are 1,500 to 2,000 feet. So not too
That's
big
not
of a
bad.
Climb.
That's not bad. No, not at all. I actually have a friend on Prince of Wales.
Mm-hmm.
And I might. He keeps inviting me. That would be like a lodge hunt.
Sure.
Well, I mean, it'd be hunting out of his house, basically. But and I kind of like the idea. My wife likes the idea about that because there's no brown bears there.
Exactly.
So I don't know. I might actually make that one work here because it's going to be a lot less expensive for me. But something about the whole Kodiak thing, really, you know, just the
yeah.
the allure of it. Kind of, I'm kind of torn.
Yeah, because you can hunt these Sitka blacktail all over Southeast Alaska on all those islands.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the brush down there. It rains a lot more. The brush is really, really thick until you get above alpine.
Mm-hmm.
So I've liked Kodiak. It's more of an adventure. You get to see bears. You see
right.
mountain goats. You're on Kodiak, and the fishing is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, see, I've heard that. That's cool. We're actually, my next big trip is 2020. I'm planning a red stag hunt in Argentina.
Oh, great.
Yeah. I actually have one slot open if you want to come in. I got it. smoking deal, man. Like, that's, stupid.
That sounds once in a lifetime. I don't know if my wife would go for it.
We're bringing the wives. You got to take her with.
Oh, bringing the wives. Oh, no. Now she's going to want to go.
Yeah, you bring the wife, and we're going to go to wine country after for 3 days.
Oh, wow. That
so,
sounds fun.
Yeah. The wives get to shoot like a fallow deer or anything like that.
Cool.
Like, guys included in it, so it's pretty sweet. Yeah, I can't complain. It's a freaking sweet deal. So if you're interested, let me know. I'll let you know in the details. But that's going to be my next, like, big hunt
Yeah.
Like I actually have to pay for other than normal tags and travel and whatever. But I might try to squeeze that, you know, Alaskan. If not this year, definitely by 2021, I would definitely have to go because, like, I'm not getting any freaking younger, man.
Yeah.
It's getting harder and harder to do this shit. Yep. So
everything gets more expensive and harder to do it. So
yeah.
Now is the best.
I'm so mad at myself because I had so many opportunities to go caribou hunting for like $1,700, like kill two caribou for $1,700. This was like, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. And now it's like, fuck.
It's one of the harder species to get now, more expensive it's and tough.
Well, now I know the herds aren't doing what, you know, what they used to be.
Yep.
Yeah.
They go up and down a lot. Those
crazy,
caribou.
Crazy, crazy. I want to do that bad too. That's another one. Caribou tastes great. I've had a chance to have some, but I've never actually gotten hunted for one. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of hunts out there. I think, you know, everyone looks at these dream hunts as like a sheep hunt or something that costs $20,000 or $30,000. It's like there's lots of other opportunities. Save a couple $1,000s.
Right.
Explore some of these hunts, and you could go have a great time.
Yeah. Yeah, you can make sheep hunts. I mean, hell, just in Arizona. I mean, you want an awesome hunt, go coos that hunting.
Exactly. Do it every year. Archery or over-the-counter, rifle, leftover, whatever.
Seriously. This year, man, oh, I wish I was the trigger man. We had one of my clients, I had him, in one day, we had him on $4. One morning, $4 that were over 100 inches.
Oh.
And he was in kill range, like under 50 yards on two of
them. Wow. Couldn't make it happen.
No. And you know what? He did a great job. It's just he's new. He was a new bow hunter. Not new hunting, new to hunting, but new to bow hunting. And we ended up getting him a javelin on the last day. But, man, he had some great opportunities. I have a buck that I've been watching down there. It's like 127 inches that I've been dying to kill myself. But every time I'm like, oh, it's my turn to go hunt, I don't find him.
Yeah.
And every time I'm down there with somebody else, I find them. It's like I can't get them killed. So it's like, but anyway, there's a lot of opportunity, a lot of good things to be done, you know, for not a lot of money.
Yep,
you know?
For sure.
So, before I let you go, share with me your most memorable hunting experience. Something maybe changed the way that you hunt today.
Change the way that I hunt today.
Or something about a species maybe that you learned and now, like, you hunt them that way all the time. Like,
yeah.
You learned this was the thing, you know?
Trying to think. It's still probably elk. You know, when I grew up in Arizona, and it was always tough to get an elk tag, as you know. And so when I started putting it, when I was 10, I told my dad, I just want a cow tag. I just want to kill something.
Right, right.
Well, then when you finally draw your cow tag after 3 or 4 years, you're like, why did I do that? I just want a bull.
Right.
And so I didn't draw my bull tag. Oh, and I was probably 21 before I drew my first bull tag. It was early archery. And so that was my first real experience of hunting archery bulls the right way on my own in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And I really was frustrated at the hunting pressure. Other hunters, why are they blowing their bugles out their windows? Why are they driving their four-wheelers around and prime time, you know, it was frustrating to me. And I learned from my dad that we need to use all these other hunters to our advantage.
Yep.
And I remember that changing my way of thinking. We ended up hunting right on the border and found the perfect scenario where the guys are going to be on the road over here blowing their calls and they're going to get pressured from this side. And this is a little pocket they're going to have to walk to.
Right.
And, you know, it's one of those things you laid out. I mean, this is before maps on our phone
and before
we all had GPSs like we do now, but we figured that out. We set up and sure enough, here's all these elk coming right to us. And it changed my thinking on where to be, how to approach it, how to have a good hunt in a high pressure, lots of tags, public land scenario.
Yep.
And all these elk came right to us and literally bedded right on top of us.
Yep.
And it's such a fun video because they come in and the cows and the calves lay right down to us. The bull's about 50 yards away, bedded behind a tree, so I have no shot. And we just sat there with them for half an hour, 45 minutes. And you can hear guys at the cabin and you can hear four-wheelers driving by, you know, and those elk have no care in the world because they're just out of distance from pressure. Yep. And yet we're standing right there in the middle of the herd. And that bull finally got up and came towards his cows, and I shot him with my bow. And that was just a monumental hunt with my dad. Like, you can do this on public land.
Yeah.
You can have a good hunt where so many guys get frustrated that it's not their, they're not the only one out there, or mm-hmm. that someone bumped the elk and now they screwed him up. Like, just play that to your advantage.
Yep. Absolutely.
I pull up to a point and then I see five other trucks there. I'm like, well, I'm not going to mess up their hunt, but they're probably going to make my hunt better if I play my cards right.
Exactly.
So that probably changed the way of thinking more than most other hunts, and been trying to apply that anywhere I go. I see other hunters. It's like, that's great. He's experiencing and has the same goals I have. I'm glad to see other hunters doing it, but I'm still a little selfish, and I'm going to make this hunt the best I can for me.
I mean, that's what you're there to do. And it's funny, like, I have that same philosophy. I do get upset when I'm going to a spot that was planning on going to, and there's somebody there.
Yeah.
That's a different...
It's frustrating.
That's a different ball game for me. But I've been hunting high-pressured units. I don't ever put in for a trophy. I don't know, limited entry. I mean, very, very, very few tags. Obviously, you know, I drew sheep tag. I got a pretty good elk tag last year, or 2 years ago. But for the most part, I hunt these super high-pressured. I mean, I grew up that way back in New York. I mean, it's literally like a war zone. You go out there, it's like there's freaking bullets flying over your head. If you go, my dad stopped taking me rifle hunting when I was a kid. Mm. So that's kind of how I actually picked up bow hunting. You know, you start looking for, like, sorry, back east is a good example. I would go and I would park. Everybody parks in there, you know, in the parking lot for this WMA that's, you know, public land allotted for hunting. And they all traipse into the woods, and you hunt right there by the parking lot, and that's where the deer are at.
Exactly.
You know, just like stuff like that. You know, and I learned to apply that out here, you know. So.
Yep, all those unconventional ways that, you know, a lot of guys think, I got to go the deepest, I got to go the furthest away, but that's not always true.
Nope.
No, my list is always, when you're looking at a map, look for alfalfa, burns, fires, private land, Indian reservation, you know, corner pinch points. Like, you look for all of those things.
Yep.
They're not going to be in the middle of your unit. They may be on the fringes. They may be on the edge.
Yeah.
And that's where you can use the public pressure to your advantage and have a good time.
Yeah. Like that on Onyx maps, they have that thing now that shows you the roadless areas. You know, that's freaking pretty money.
Highlights the density of roads and how far away you are.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Yep.
That helps a lot. So, well, cool, man. I'm glad you took a few minutes here to share the story with us. And come on. We definitely, I'd like to get a couple of you guys on here before tag season goes by and talk about some tag stuff. Eventually.
For sure. We're in the thick of it right now. Yeah. We got draw results for Alaska come out today. Arizona just ended, and all the other states coming up.
Yep, for sure. Definitely, I'd like to do a couple different states with the. I actually got a hold of Robert. He was supposed to get on with me here next week, I think.
Good.
So we're going to have him on.
Well, that's what we do. We talk about it all day, and we'd love to help out.
Sweet. Well, awesome, man. Thanks for coming on, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Sean.
Hey, guys. Want to stay connected with the podcast? Check out my blog, johnstallone.me. That's www.johnstallone.me. And you could go on there. On the top right-hand corner, there's a little subscribe box. Quickly put in an email address, hit subscribe, and boom, you're done. There's a lot of great information on there, a lot of posts that go hand-in-hand with the podcast that we do, plus gear reviews, plus we have the signature T-shirts on there, the I Eat Fast Food T-shirts, and the Tuesday Coosday shirts. It's a really good way to stay connected with the podcast. And thanks for listening.